better not put this in the book or anything, but basically her parents didn't want to know. Mm. And she felt so sorry for her, she took her home herself. And basically brought her up, you know.
No, I've heard amazing things about her.
She was very much old school.
Yeah.
You know, didn't do things by the book.
Yeah.
Done things that had to be done, needed to be done, not filling out forms.
That's exactly what, I mean, you know, when Klaus Newman gave a talk at the Welcome, he mentioned her by name, you know, and said, you know, said if it wasn't for staff like that, you know, all of those young doctors wouldn't have coped.
No. And she was a single woman, no children, and I think she took us on as her children, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was amazing. Totally dedicated.
I suppose one final question to ask about this early part as well, though, is your parents, are they both still living? I think you said your father
No, my
died.
Dad died about 4 years ago.
Right. So we'll talk about that in the adult part. But your mum is still alive.
Oh, very much so.
And is she, you still see her?
Yeah, at least once a week. She lives on the other side of Swindon.
Right.
We take her shopping and do things like that. So does my sister. So we make sure she's okay and everything. But she's what we call a born again teenager.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So anything further about life until the end of the teens?
No, that's really it, really.
You might think of some more things later or when I send you the transcription probably. As well. So.
Oh, right, okay.
Do you want to take a break and now? And then?
Yeah, if you want to, yeah.
Or do you want to, we can go straight on into adulthood, or do you want to have a
little
break first?
It's up to you. I'll probably have a cup of coffee, actually. That's okay.
Let's have a little break, yeah.
Or just...
Yeah, so you were just telling me about sense of humour in your family and a joke that you used to play in the car.
Yeah, when we used to drive down to London and my dad had an estate vehicle, when he would fold the back down, so the three of us, my brother, sister and myself, would just roll about in the back and we'd get bored with this, so we'd entertain other drivers. My brother would... either put me up his jumper, so my head would poke through and his would disappear. So you got this little tiny head with a big body. Or he'd put his coat on me and hide behind me. So I was swamped by a huge coat. And then he put his hands through, which was huge hands up against my little body. And then he'd do things like scratch my eye and pick my nose. And how we didn't have other people crashing is unbelievable.
What sort of reaction did you get?
Mostly, people would laugh.
Yeah.
Absolutely laugh, yeah, and follow us, that sort of thing. And we'd do stuff like that, and it was just taking the mickey out of the disability, really.
Yeah.
But on our terms.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And, we'd do loads of things like that. My brother thought it was funny to roll me down a hill if we were outside. But he always looked after me, you know, if anybody, he would do things, but if anybody else, then he was there.
Yeah.
So, and, we just muck about, just like normal kids.
Are you still close to them now?
My brother died 20 years ago.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm still close to my sister. Yeah.
How did your brother die?
Brain tumour.
Right.
Yeah, it was just after, I got married. He was my best man. And he was going through a rough patch at work. And we thought he was being stressed out because of that. And I went on my honeymoon. While I was on my honeymoon, it was his birthday. So I phoned home and found out that he had a biopsy. And then when I got back, found out that he was cancer. So he died 3 months after I got married.
Gosh, so he died quite soon after being diagnosed then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very quick.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That's sad.
It was quite sad seeing him in the hospital because he'd always been my mum was my family is divided. My dad is the reader. the philosopher, and my mum was the sportsy person, and my brother took after her. And he was the type that if he was playing cricket, he'd go and get all the gear. Whatever he took up, he got all the gear and he played it to his best. So he's quite a big bloke, quite a big strapping bloke. And then the cancer just took it away and he became this frail little old man, hair falling out. And it was sad to see. It really is quite sad to see.
Yeah.
It's not the way I'd like to go. If I found out I had anything like that, I'd want to be topped.
Well, I suppose it's, you've always got that hope, haven't you, I suppose, that you know, something might come along. And
it was too late, it was too riddled in him that there was, you know, after trials and tests, he, 5-10 years, there's no way. So, yeah, it was about 20 years ago. Sad time, but we all survived it and got on.
Okay, let's take our break now.
Right.
Okay, so this is the second part of the interview now, and we're going to talk about early adulthood, further education, career, relationships, that kind of thing. Did you go on to further education after school?
I did, yeah. I went to Heriwood College, which was for the disabled.
How do you spell that? Hero?
H-E-R-E-W-A-R-D.
Yeah.
It was strange, really, because I was leaving school. I was encouraged to stay on to the sixth form, which I didn't want to do. But I was encouraged to do it because they didn't know what else to do with me. You know, the councils, whatever, people didn't know what to do with me. So they encouraged me to pad out another year, which I hated. And hardly attended, really, just to make it easier for them to search around for something. Then they came up with an idea that I go to this college. Now, I wanted to go, like yourself, to an art college. Back then, accessibility to anything what I would deem to be a proper college wasn't around. So they lied to me, basically. They said, Heriwood College has a very good art course. I read that as being, it's an art college. And I went up there, I'd done my first day assessment, stayed overnight, which was initially weird because I was 17 at the time, and I never really mixed with disabled people. So it was the first time, so that's a bit of an eye-opener. And I survived the night, basically, with people helping me who weren't my parents, which again was strange, but okay, I mucked in and got around it. They didn't really go into much of what the courses were, because I was only there for the day, so I assumed it was, I would be doing art. And then I said, okay, I'll sign up for that. It looks okay. It was in Coventry. So I left Stevenage and became a boarder at Coventry. And the first week there, they said, okay, what courses do you want to do? So I said, well, I'm here to do art. Yes, okay, art. Now you have to do another 7 courses. I said, what do you mean, another 7? And they said, no, you can't just do art. I said, that's what I'm here for. And they said, no, 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 it's not what it's here about. So I had to redo history, English, maths, all the stuff that I'd done at school, all the things I got exam results for, again. So
at
I got
exactly
into
the same level as you'd already done.
Yeah. So I got it into my head because it was, as I say, I was 17, it was back in 77. It was the time of punk and rebellion and everything. I'd come from a normal school which was full of rebellion, and I said, right, okay, I thought to myself, you've lied to me, I'll lie to you. So literally I would turn up for all the classes, literally I'd do nothing, and the only one I did was art. And come the exams, I failed all the exams but the art one, but it wasn't enough, and they it was one of the reasons why they kicked me out after a year.
Was this the first time you'd left home?
Yeah.
Actually lived away from home. Mm. And so how long were you there for?
A year.
1 year. Okay.
I should have been there for 3 years. Yeah. But as I said, I got kicked out for the first.
And what qualifications was it to get then? Was that O levels?
All O levels, yeah. All O levels. Which I'd already got at school.
Which you'd already got at school. And what did you do after that?
I still pursued my art interest. And so I done an open university course. Mm. Again, very misleading. It was basically art to open university is literature and furniture, and not very much about art itself.
Right. Interesting.
So it was a mixture of, I found it too dull. Basically, it wasn't what I wanted to do, so I gave that up, and went on to. I had a home tutor for art, which I carried on doing, and again I got I got right to the end of getting a qualification with her, and typical of my luck, my art teacher goes blind.
What?
Yeah, which is really weird. So she had to stop. And that was it.
And when were you living back at home then?
Then, yeah, I was back at home.
Yeah.
I mean, my college social life was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because I was just turned 17.
Yeah.
And I had a raucous time. We were out drinking, me and a few mates that I made there. Mm. Again. Mm. Enter stage left, right? Oh.
You're brilliant.
Oh, it's all right, it's got something in it. Thank you.
Saving that Thanks, for later.
Yeah, I'd Frank, out. I absolutely bore it at college. I was young. I made some friends who'd also gone to normal schools and were thrown in the deep end with disabled people. So we sort of grouped together. It was hysterical, in a way. There'd be disabled kids there that had obviously been either in homes or very, very nurtured at home, and at least special schools, who would turn up with brand new denim jackets with patches on. And I couldn't relate to that. I thought, you only put patches on once you scuffed the jacket. And then they were all trying to be hard. And they, because they were second year students, a lot of them, they were pushing us first year students around. And I'd already just left a school that I couldn't stand by this time, of being pushed around by blokes who were in their, 6 footers and fit.
Yeah,
there was no way I was going to stand for it with somebody who could just about talk in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So I heavily rebelled against that.
Yeah.
And so me and this small clan stuck together, and we went out drinking, partying, had a good time.
And were there other thalidomiders there?
Not at that time, no. I think I was the first one to go.
Well, probably because you were that little bit older as well.
Yeah.
So living away from home was good the first time round.
Yeah. That was a great time.
Yeah. And what about, did you have any kind of ongoing health concerns or medical interventions at that time? Or were you still?
I haven't since the age of 14.
So you were lucky.
Yeah. Very lucky.
Yeah. So you came back home and you did your open university course. Mm-hmm. And did you at some point try to find a career or a job?
Well, while I was at college, I had the careers officer come round, who offered me a job. And he said, he knows a one going, that involved painting tiles, wall tiles, floor tiles, which I found as a bit of a slow at first, but I thought, hey ho, you know, I'm not Rembrandt, got to stay at the bottom. And I said, yeah, fine, I'm interested. So I said, and how many years do you have to be there before you can start designing the tiles? And he said, oh no, you'll never design a tile. You'll only, there'll be designers and you'll always paint them, which to me is painting by numbers. And I said, thank you, but no thanks. And it, as it turned out, it was a disabled workshop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, or a sweatshop, basically. And
yeah, yeah.
After that, I got really disheartened. I was offered a couple of jobs of pen pushing. And I'm so not a pen pusher.
No.
I mean, if I have to write a letter, I get depressed. You know, I like activity and creativity. And to sit behind a desk would just kill me.
Yeah.
At that point, I knew, I'd known for a couple of years, that I had enough money behind me if I wasn't stupid, that I wouldn't have to work. So I never bought anything flash like the, like some of the beneficiaries did. They bought really flash cars and spent their money. I always kept it low key.
Yeah.
I also kept it low key because I was, the kids I was knocking about with in Stevenage, if I turned up with a really flash car and they're driving an Escort, I wouldn't stay around for long.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I fitted in with what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, they were as good as gold if we went to the pub. I was never one of those beneficiaries, hey-ho, I'll buy all the rounds if you be my friend. I'll buy my round, they'd buy their round, we'd get on. And that's the way we lived.
And you were still, but you still carried on living at home?
I was still at home,
at that point,
yeah.
Okay. And so who were these friends in Stevenage then? How did you know them? Were they like old school friends?
Or? A couple of old school friends. One was a family friend who I'm still in contact with to this day. And then made a few friends because I was on CB. So you make a few friends there. And, you know, it just spreads like that.
A lot of people have done CB radio, actually.
It's another way of hiding behind a screen.
That was the breaker thing, wasn't
it? Sad.
Very probably sad. Very good fun at the time,
though. Oh, it was magic at the time.
Okay, so I'm not going to ask you any of those questions about having a job. What about contact with other people affected by thalidomide at this point? Were you still ever going to events put on by the Thalidomide Society, or were you going then, or
as
thalidomide
I said, the
trust
the
holidays?
No, I never went on a trust holiday.
Okay.
Again, like I told you before, I've always been cynical. And I'd hear stories that, I don't know if I was rebellious or just an angry young man, really, but there were people of my disability group that would go on these holidays, and after week one, the helpers, who had been paid for by the beneficiary, got tired. So they'd start putting them to bed about 6 o'clock.
Really?
And other beneficiaries would have to help them. And to me, there's just no justice in that. You know, you pay your money, you do your job. And there was no way I was going to fall into that trap.
So, but in terms of having any peer support from other thalidomiders at that point, were you still in touch with any of the peers?
No, not really. Yearly at AGMs, meet up. Then, I think when I was about 19, the hotel in Jersey was formed. And I used to go there every year. Because it probably sounds weird that like a group of disabled people were under one roof. But it was so fun.
Oh, it doesn't sound weird at all. It sounds, everything everybody's told me about that.
It's surreal times. Really.
Well, yes, people have said it was surreal.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, you sort of don't have to explain yourself to anybody, do you? Because if you all know you're there for the same reason.
Exactly. The only way I can describe it is because we're all roughly the same age, give or take a year. Thalidomide people, and I probably would be criticised for this, are really different from other disability groups. Like, we have an arrogance, we have a forthrightness, we have a go-get type attitude. We don't sit back and expect things. So if you can imagine a hotel of about 15 of us, all with a drink problem, it was 2 weeks of just sheer mayhem.
Yes, yeah.
And it was great.
And where do you think that, this is something that other people have said as well about thalidomide being different from other disabled groups. Why? What's your theory behind why that is?
I think because we were all grouped together from a very early age. Although we didn't mix with one another constantly, when we did meet up, it was like the time hasn't passed. I don't know. There is a certain arrogance and bullheadedness amongst our group. You know, we're here. If you don't like it, tough on you. That type of attitude. And it's, I like it. I like that type of attitude better.
Have you come across any bitterness or negative attitudes towards thalidomide as getting compensation when other disabled groups don't?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Some has been in print, in a magazine called Disability Now. Years ago, there used to be the odd article from other disabled groups about our group that all we think about is money. Other groups aren't too happy with us. And I can understand it. You know, they're born disabled. They have the same hardships we have.
Yeah.
And they've got to rely on the state. Whereas we've been compensated and, you know, they hear us moaning because we haven't got a Maserati or a Ferrari. You know, why can't we have one? And they're going, well, why can't we have a car?
Yeah.
So I can understand them totally, you know, it's just, it's quite unfair.
Yeah. But the origins of, you know, disability caused by thalidomide are so different, aren't they? So, you know, it's sort of what Martin always calls a man-made disaster, doesn't he?
Yeah. We have someone we can point a finger at.
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah. Relationships. Did you, he nodded sagely. did your impairment affect your ability to find a partner?
No, not really. I would say my first real girlfriend, looking back, I bamboozled her to go out with me. And that lasted a few years and just fizzled. Then I was in the wilderness for a while. And I picked up with another beneficiary.
Was your first girlfriend a beneficiary?
No, she's at school.
Yeah.
School with me. I had a little girlfriend as well when I was at infants, but I don't think that really counts.
You can't count.
No. so I picked up with another beneficiary. That didn't work out on my part. Then had a dalliance with another one, beneficiary. That was definitely not going to work out because we both agreed to that. It was more of a one-night thingy. Then I picked up with Geraldine, who I met at an AGM. And after about 3 years, we got married. Now a couple of years after that, a few years after that, we had two kids.
Tell me a bit more about Geraldine, though. Hey? Who was Geraldine, then? Was she a beneficiary?
She's a beneficiary, yeah.
Okay.
She's got nearly full-length arms and short legs like myself, you know, flipper feet.
So she uses a wheelchair as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first met her, she was using a push wheelchair. Again, I said to her, why the hell are you doing that? It's putting a lot of strain on you. So she eventually got an electric wheelchair. And as I say, I moved in with her pretty quick. She was living in Mansfield at the time, and I went to stay with her after a couple of weeks after the AGM, and then that was it. We were together then. Then she moved to Swindon, got a place, moved in there with her. Then we got married, then we had the kids, and then she divorced me. I can't understand why. So after about, I think we were married about 15 years.
Yeah.
And she said she'd had enough, and I was divorced.
How easy was it to get, like, first of all, was when you got married to Geraldine, was that then the next time that you moved out of the family, your family's home, out of, from your parents?
Yeah, after I met
Geraldine. Yeah.
Moved out.
With her. Yeah. Mm. And how easy was it at that time to sort of adapt a house for two wheelchairs?
Initially, not too bad. The only reason we moved from the place that we had in Swindon was we wanted children and it really wasn't possible to have two wheelchairs and a child.
Yeah.
Although we did have my oldest there, but he was about 1.5 when we moved into a barn conversion, and then about another year and a half after that, our second came along.
And did you get some help?
Yeah, we got a home help.
Yeah,
because that's what the council do. You know, you got two small kids, but we can clean your cupboards. But very understanding home helps. They understood what was needed, so they would help with the kids. And do a bit of cleaning sort of thing. So that was good.
Yeah, so how did, because you said you had two boys. Actually, you said that to me off the tape, not on the tape. So when you got to that point of time when you, you know, had two crazy little boys running around and you were both in wheelchairs, was that difficult?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I find with all the beneficiaries' children, they are amazing. They don't adapt because they're born into it. But I haven't noticed any not being very caring, very helpful, very understanding. When I say helpful, I'm not saying they are slaves, because a lot of people think that you have children as carers.
Yeah.
But they are far not. If they don't want to do anything, they will disappear. But it's second nature. If I drop anything, one of them will pick it up automatically and just pass it to me.
Yes.
Without even thinking.
Yeah.
From an early age, we knew that we were going to have trouble. We couldn't chase after them if they ran off. So voice control was very important.
Yeah.
Geraldine trained the boys to hold onto a wheelchair, which they did, which my youngest still does now, even without thinking. If I'm going around the street, he'll hold onto the back of my wheelchair, because he's that's the way he was trying to do it.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting.
But they were good as well. I mean, they automatically open doors. But I find that with all the beneficiary kids, they're really, really good kids.
Did you have... or was it suggested to you at any point that there might be a genetic inheritance component of thalidomide that could pass on to the children?
Yeah, there was a rumour going around, but I'm too practical for that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way our genes were altered. The embryo was altered, not the gene. So there's no way I was worried that it was going to be passed on. I remember going into the... when Geraldine was being examined, and the nurse or whatever said to me, "Oh, the baby's got long legs," and I thought, "Well, I was expecting that." You know, I wasn't expecting a sort of a penguin or anything. You know, and I used to wind them up. I loved watching people's faces. They used to say, "And what are you hoping for?" Meaning boy or girl. And I used to say spinal bifida, because I said, "We've already got the home adapted, it'd be ideal." And they were horrified by that.